Today is October the 6th, 2006, and we are sitting here with Earl Staley. Earl, you know a little bit about this recording project and looking back to the 50s, 60s, 70s in Houston. You can start in anywhere about how you came to Houston. When did you come here?
I got here to Houston in 1966. With a job at Rice University in the beginning stages of Rice University's art program. So John O'Neill hired me to teach primarily printmaking and then drawing. Our majors we were dealing with were architecture students. So he hired me from my job. I was at Washington University in St. Louis for 3 years, and then I was fortunate enough to get here in 1966, which seemed like the very beginning of the art world here, although it wasn't, but it really, there wasn't that many of us here, mm-hmm. and I was the youngest one. So I was at Rice for 3 years and had a great time.
Now, had Mrs. Demanil at the Institute come over at that point?
No, I left Rice when they moved in.
I see.
And so I moved from Rice to St. Thomas and built a studio program with Jack Boynton and Pat Caldwell beginning in, 69?
So the Demanils went over to Rice to start Institute for the Arts at Rice, and you went to St. Thomas where they had just left and picked up to enrich that art program.
That's right, yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about the beginning days of that program over at St. Thomas that the three of you wrapped your arms around. What was it like?
There wasn't anything there other than a leftover art history program. There was no studio. But the priests embraced the idea of a studio program. We were all part-time.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the years of the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
So they were overwhelmed with males. And suddenly the studio program was very popular. So within a half year, they needed a full-time person. And Jack didn't want to be full-time because he wanted to be an artist. And Pat Caldwell didn't want to do it. And so I did. Because I was teaching part-time at St. Thomas, and I was also teaching part-time at the community college in Galveston.
Wow.
Driving back and forth there. So I had two jobs. So they offered me a full-time job, and they also offered me the chairmanship. So at 20s, late 20s, I was a department chairman of this fast-growing, art program, which, because Jack and I and Pat worked together and we had no problems in terms of agreeing, what do you want to do? Okay, do that. We did that, and we attracted lots of students. So at the high point, we had over 110 majors.
Wow.
And they had built a new, this is maybe 4 years later, we had already taken over three buildings. And then they built a new library, and the old library was vacant, and they gave us the library. Now it's no longer. But it was the art department with a huge gallery. So we had this big space and an art gallery, and then we had, this would have been early 70s. We had also the annex, this dump we called the annex, which was sculpture ceramics. So it was a very good time. Some of my best students are still around and working either as artists or in one of the art-related fields.
Well, did the three of you, when this opportunity came up, did you sort of sit down and have a little powwow about, okay, we have an opportunity to design a program, what do we want it to do? Or
no,
did you just kind of work from the kinds of places that you had been and what you had studied?
I barely knew Jack, and I didn't know Pat Caldwell at all, or I'd barely met her too. And so really, this program probably was presented through Caldwell Boynton, who was the first, I don't know,
mm-hmm.
and probably Pat, because Pat would have been a little more aggressive than Jack. And they got me into it. It started with Herb Applewhite, who was the head of the music program, later became a cult follower and died
mm-hmm.
by his own hand.
Mm-hmm.
Very strange. Wonderful guy, but got weirder and weirder. But he was active in getting us involved in this. So we had Herb Applewhite behind us and supporting us, and the fathers of the court of us. Father Braden was in charge, and he always supported us, amazingly enough.
Well, how long did that department stay in place?
I'm not sure exactly, because I was out of the country in the 80s. I was living in Rome. I think it was disbanded by the priests for economic reasons, allegedly, around 82. And they said it cost too much. And probably there was less and less majors. The males left after the war.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were down to a female population. I wonder, one class I had in the, probably around 1980, which was 90% young ladies from South America. It was a strange class.
When you came to Houston in the mid-60s, I guess, mm-hmm. we'd say, what was it like? How did it feel to you? What was the city like?
It was really welcoming. It was wonderful. I mean, the first night I was here, I went to an art gallery, a Kiko gallery, and mm-hmm. there was all these fancy people walking around. They were happy to see me. We just felt like, wow, I came out of St. Louis, which was, you know, just really a big city, which had a lot of history behind it, and they really didn't have anything to do with the arts. But here, people, at least they were interested in it, they were supportive of it, and they didn't buy much. It was a lot of fun. There was art galleries all over. Mm-hmm. David Gallery was in operation along with Kiko. Louisiana Gallery was mm-hmm. where I had my first show within a year or so. So there was a great interest in not many artists, but it's just a sense of opportunity and interest in what we did.
Do you think, looking back, that that sort of artistic interest and vitality, do you have any sense about, do you think it was always there, or do you think it kind of picked up in the early 60s? And then I wonder, did you ever think that, do you think the Manils, the Dimanils had any sort of input on, they were stirring the pot.
They never cared about their contemporary artists. They never, except for Jim, who they gave a job to and more or less helped, but I don't think they really
right.
thought anything about us in town. It was always a complaint that I had that you know, they didn't care about their local artists. You know, it was all outside of us
mm-hmm.
here. But I felt that just that there was an interest in it. The Contemporary Arts Association Museum was still off of South Main, and then they built that building. But that was going on. There was always something happening, and you could get to the people. You know, the people who were collectors then and that, they were all very interested in us, and the few artists that I met slowly, they were always great fun. There wasn't a lot of them.
Who were some of those artists?
Well, the first person I met was Bill Canfield. But after that, I really can't remember what artists I met first. Not being an outgoing person then, particularly, I pretty much stayed at Rice doing my job there. And next year, Bob Canfield was hired. Bob Camblin was hired by Rice. John O'Neill again hired him. And so I had Camblin, who was much more gregarious, and we started hanging out and meeting more people. So I didn't meet Jack for probably a year after that. Now that's me, being rather standoffish and arrogant, etc., as a very young man.
What was Rice like?
Oh, dead.
Dead?
Well, Rice didn't like me because I was too outrageous for him. I was told that if you get out of line at Rice or raise your head above the swamp, you know, you will not last long there. And I offended him. I was a young man. I was arrogant. I pissed him off. John O'Neill had the great ability to hire people that he immediately didn't like. He didn't like me right away, and he didn't like Campbell, and then after that, he hired Joe Tate, of all things, to replace me. And, of course, Tate was worse than me. So it was John, I love and hate him, but he was quite a character. He just hired people that he had a hard time making up his mind, and many of us made up his mind. He hired me, and then Campbell. Campbell and I had a great time together. Man, we had a ball. And even after I left, we kept working together, of course. And luckily, I didn't have to leave. I got into St. Thomas, which was a really liberal policy there.
Yeah.
Don't ask, don't tell.
Just do.
We just did it. And now I look back and say, God, we got away with that. We did that. But for those great years, in the 70s, when we had a huge body of students and we had a gallery there, we were doing very exciting shows and things were happening there. This was before U of H took off. But it's too bad that there's only one school in town. Well, I guess there's two, but one that you can go to get an art degree.
That's
you can't
true.
Go to St. Oh, yes, you can now. They are associated with the museum school.
Well, Earl, you let's go back before you came to Houston. How did you become an artist? Did you know from as a little boy that you were an artist, or how did that evolve for you?
No, I didn't. I knew I was artistically inclined because Mother kept pushing me in that direction, and I knew I couldn't do sports because of my eyes. And so I was into crafts and Boy Scouts and crafts and making things like that. I was involved with Indian lore as a Boy Scout and Indian things in Chicago, Illinois area, by the way. And then I got to college in Bloomington, Illinois Wesleyan. And I saw some people that looked like they were rather interesting doing things. And I said, who are they? And somebody said, well, they're the art school. I went over there. I said, I am not going to be a businessman. I'm sorry, Dad, I can't do this. I cannot take over your business.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became an artist.
Painter first, printmaker first.
Painter first. And then you get involved with printmaking. And so my first job actually was in St. Louis teaching printmaking. And then at Rice, they hired me for printmaking.
Mm-hmm.
Too messy, too technically involved. Get somebody else to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was nice, but you know, all you're doing is cleaning up after somebody.
Well, Earl, while you were in school studying your painting and printmaking, how were your teachers?
They simply said, there's a painting, there's your canvas, paint on it. There's somebody to draw it. So I recall no teaching of anything other than attitude. I got a lot of attitude. We were all abstract expressionists and such. But in terms of teaching rules and how to do it, nobody taught me anything. I had to teach myself very much long time later. After undergraduate school, I worked for my dad for a year and decided I wanted to go to graduate school. I wanted to become a teacher. I didn't want to be a business person. So I applied a number of places. At one place, I have this strange tick of doing strange things, of going perhaps the wrong place. So I applied and I ended up going to the University of Arkansas.
For your teaching?
For my graduate degree, which had a allegedly progressive art program. It was progressive enough, I guess, but I felt really isolated being in the Fayetteville, Arkansas in the 63 through 66, when most of these people had never been to a museum. So I fought my way out, and I became a representational painter there, which they didn't like because you were supposed to be an abstract painter, so they didn't know what to do with me. But they gave me a degree. And luckily from there, I got a job in St. Louis at WashU, which was just wonderful. It was a three-year appointment, mm-hmm. But it got me started. And it got me back into a big city, which had a great museum. And the school itself had the Max Beckmann tradition, because Max taught there for a couple of years in the late 40s. So there was Beckmann collections, and the May department store had a huge collection of things there. So it was a museum, and there were a few. I had my first show there, a gallery. And this was nice. And then they let me go, and I got to Rice.
When did you get the Prix de Rome? When did you go to Rome?
81.
81.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Applied for it. So it's a competition. You simply mm-hmm. send in slides, and they go through the slides and say yes or no. I applied when I was living in St. Louis and got as a finalist. Then as a finalist, you had to send your work there. So I remember building a crate and sending this work there. But I had been a finalist 10 years before I reapplied.
Well, what was that experience like? Oh. Rome, being in Rome. Fabulous.
Best thing that ever happened to our lives. It was just wonderful. And we stayed on there, of course, for almost 4 years. And so when I say, where do you want to live? I say Rome. I can't live there because they don't have the economic possibilities there, and it's expensive. But Rome was stupendous, eye-opening, just wonderful.
And you integrated all that into your work.
I was painting Roman mythologies and subjects and working from nature and working from the Roman landscape or the Mediterranean landscape. All of that was just like a fast dream. 4 years went by like, and when I came back to Houston, the whole art world had changed.
How?
It was the influx of the program at Glassell. What do you call it?
The Glassell School?
The Glassell School's program for advanced.
Oh, the course?
The core had come in.
Alan Hacklin had come to.
Yeah, and that was like suddenly the art world that I had left was small, compact. We used to hang out at Chaucer's and do all that number and had all that time. When I came back, there was this enormous amount of difference in the art world. Of course, then Barbara Rose did the Fresh Paint Show, which was unique and wonderful for everybody in Houston. But then the world changed. No longer, suddenly it became a huge group of people that suddenly I didn't know anybody.
That's interesting, that observation, because I think maybe because you were gone and came back, you were able to put your finger on it.
Yeah.
No one's mentioned that the core fellows coming in, the broadening that occurred.
It broadened this whole community into a less insular, I guess, and less tight community. It was a very, it's probably where you're in this period that you're talking about up to around 1974, 75, that was when you could go down to Chaucer's at night and everybody was there. On Thursday night, every artist in town that could get away from their wife or whatever was there.
Mm-hmm.
And the museum people were there, and everybody else that hung around was there, and so it was just like you felt like you were a community. It was heaven for me because I just got a divorce. Well, that's where I met my wife, so it was just
Suzanne. Beautiful.
It's a great place. Yeah, Suzanne was there. Got here as a job interview for Rice in the summer, and they put me up at the Plaza Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing John O'Neill did was take me to the Museum of Fine Arts, and there was this gorgeous Georgie O'Keeffe show with her enormous cloud paintings hanging in that the old building. And I was just like, whoa, this is just beautiful, wow. And then I don't know what other galleries he did, if he took me to any other galleries. It was only here a day. But I remember that. And then I remember going to when we first moved here, first thing I went to was a showing at Kiko's. And then I went and met Joan Crystal at the Louisiana Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
Made a good friendship with Joan. She eventually showed my early work here.
What was her gallery like?
Oh, it was beautiful. It had pre-Columbian art all over because she was a major source of pre-Columbian. And then she had Calders on the wall, real genuine gouaches and genuine prints. Joseph Cornell works on paper. Milton Avery's. Mm-hmm. This was major stuff then.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Still
and,
is.
And then she had other art, Houston artists. I don't remember who. Otis Dozier. I remember him. Otis. He's still around.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah, it was. She was very nice. And I enjoyed that, although she didn't. Again, sales were bad. I met Catherine Swenson.
Yes.
And she had closed her gallery. She was thinking about reopening it. And she would have showed me, but she never did. But I remember visiting her during those early years. But there was an active community, and there was, you could count, there was a lot of galleries here. There was many more than there were ever in St. Louis. And those were the great years of the Diane David Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
Who were really?
What was Diane's gallery like?
It was figurative and very weirdly figurative. She liked the strange figures. I was a bit too outrageous for her, or funky, or maybe wasn't accomplished enough, which is a good way
to say. Oh no, Earl, not you.
Yeah, I've learned that that which I thought was cutting edge was sort of dulled. Almost all, if not all of my early work has been destroyed either by myself or nature. because it wasn't kept properly.
In this climate.
Yeah. I have the slides of it and all of that. But most of the, and particularly when I moved to Santa Fe, when I was going into the depths of the storage garage, things were just falling off.
That's a shame. But the humidity will do it.
Humidity did it, that's all. And there were oil paintings. Most of the acrylics lived. It was the oil paintings which cracked and fell apart. Probably because of the humidity conditions and maybe because of the way they were painted. Now, acrylic doesn't destroy. So acrylic lasted in one way or the other. But the oil paintings, except for maybe one or two I still have, which were salvageable, they were gone. They were gone.
Well, so as you remember back, there was a cohesiveness, a vitality, a sort of brother sisterhood, I guess we can call it, that was there, that was probably kind of unique for that time.
Mm-hmm. It felt real good. There wasn't any old guard standing off looking down their noses at you or anything entrenched at all, because it just, Rice was brand new. There wasn't anything going on there except for David Parsons, who was there, who I immediately fought with.
Why?
Oh, because I wouldn't bend, and he wouldn't bend, and he'd been there for hundreds of years, and he had his way of doing things, which, of course, I thought was totally stupid.
Now, your first gallery in Houston was it?
Louisiana Gallery.
Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. Louisiana Gallery.
And how long were you with Joan?
Oh, gosh.
That because
2 or 3 years, and then I ended up, because of Lefty Adler, at Meredith Long for maybe a year. And then I was without a gallery for a few years. And then when David Gallery closed down, I closed her gallery.
Your show closed the gallery?
My show was the last show at David Gallery.
Huh.
And then I was without for a couple of years, but Frederica Hunter was opening up her galleries. She opened up Contract Graphics on Morningside, very near where Charlie Shorey lived.
Mm-hmm.
Upstairs, from she rented from Charlie Shorey. And she came, she was out of Rice, and so was Ian. So we'd see each other and hang around and talk. And then probably around 74, 73, they opened the Texas Gallery, and I hung around there, and I finally said, would you be interested in giving me a show? And they said, we're thinking of that, too. So I went to Texas Gallery for a number of years.
So Texas opened in what, 73 or 4?
Yeah, I think so. The place on Bissonnette near Carl Killian's bookstore. They had a storefront along Bissonnette there called Texas Gallery. And they were showing outrageous stuff. You know, she should have bought them. Sherman, the photographer, Cindy Sherman,
mm-hmm.
her first works were there for, you know, like $300, but God, what they're worth now. David Sally.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Ed Ruscha and Billy Al Bankston.
Well, who was showing that, Frederica?
Yeah.
She had a lot of California.
California, Billy Al, Ed Ruscha, Ed Moses, who I just saw a gorgeous show of at St. in Santa Fe. Absolutely mm-hmm. beautiful paintings. Just really, woo.
Mm-hmm.
They should have not been good. They should have been sort of decorator tasty, but they weren't. They were really nice. But he's a chameleon. He changes every year. He gets away with it. So she had the beautiful California shows, and then she had those New Yorkers in there, which was very nice, and I was their token Texan.
Now, her gallery was on, it was not over on Peden where
no,
it is now.
No, this is Bissonnette. And then they moved to Peden, I don't exactly know when. And I stayed with her quite a while. What did I do? Then eventually, well, they had a hard time selling my work, and then they always had a hard time paying their artists. Is it my way? No. Okay. But you were there because it was Texas Gallery.
Sure.
It had that New York cloud. Allegedly, you were all saying, maybe they'll get me to New York. Well, don't count on that. But I'm sure that, no, what really got me going, anything career-wise, was Jim at the museum. Jim
Herathus?
Herathus.
Mm-hmm.
He, in the early 70s, when Chaucer's took off and everything, he came in here and said, no, you guys are good, too. You guys are quality work here. Things are great work are being done, and you should step up to the plate and do it. And with his support, that really made us feel good. The galleries couldn't do it. The museums certainly weren't going to do it until he showed up.
Mm-hmm.
He was
a
tremendous catalyst. Particularly for myself, and then Searles and John Alexander particularly.
Mm-hmm. And he showed you all at the museum, Contemporary Arts Museum?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then he made sure people saw the work and was always there hanging out with us and supportive of us. That was, a great man. Great man for all. Whatever his faults are, God bless him. He did it.
Well, that's interesting, Earl, because I hadn't heard that mentioned before, and that kind of a pivotal person, you know, people needs to, that he needs to be remembered.
Oh, very much. He was such a great influence on all of the arts in Houston. And he had his friends coming in. He'd bring in Norman Bloom for younger artists like Don Redman, who was a buddy of his. Don was a baby then, practically, but mm-hmm. he used to hang around with Herathus. He was part of Herathus' posse. I never was a member of the posse. I was too standoffish, too aloof from all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But with Norman Bloom and Sal Scarpetta, who's still alive at 89, still making art in New York. And so he was, these were great influences that he brought in.
Mm-hmm. Earl, do you have a couple of interesting stories in the back of your head you might want to share?
I think that it's when you finally mature as an artist and you find your own voice. You always think you do. You always think, oh, yeah, I'm doing this. But what you're doing, what I felt, was I was simply, you know, following the trends. So sometime during my late years in, no, my years in St. Okay, after I left St. Thomas and moved to St. Thomas, I was closest friends with Bob Camlin, and then became friends with my replacement, Joe Tate. And within a year, Campbell and I were sharing a studio together off of Montrose near Richmond, behind where Ben Russell had his old art supply store. The studios are all torn down. So we were a studio together, and then Joe Tate showed up, and he had the part of the studio. And then we had to move them there. And so we rented a big place down the street from St. Thomas on Sol Ross, near where the Bluebird Circle is now.
Mm-hmm.
So we had rented this big house from a foot doctor, and we took it over as a collaborative studio. And so that's where we hung out all the time. We were hanging out there, and we were conversing and talking constantly and on doing collaborative paintings. We taught ourselves. Cameron actually taught me how to paint. Cameron taught me the rules by watching him, and he and Joe and I worked together on projects and ideas and shows at St. Thomas. And whatever happened there, I began to understand a different direction.
Interesting.
Of course, all of our marriages broke up within a few years, and I had to leave that group too for survival, because they were becoming more and more incestuous in their ideas and non-product-oriented art. And I was very product-oriented. I always wanted to produce a product which somebody might love. So I moved out into my own studio off of right near here, right down the street from where we are right now. We're on Pivoteau Street, now torn down. I rented a building. I rented the bottom floor, and eventually, the next couple of years, when I was getting a divorce, I had the whole building. And it was there that I began to do my my myths, my story-making, my myth-making about my life. And I said to myself that I wasn't doing art anymore. I was simply going to tell stories in the most dramatic or outrageous way to do it. So I started doing that. Joseph Campbell's work just opened my whole eyes to everything.
Oh, yeah.
I came like, whoa, this explains so much to me at that time. So I was devouring his those fall volumes called The Masks of God. Great. I still recommend them.
Mm-hmm.
So then I started just letting it go on canvas, and I had a lot of anguish to deal with at that time, and that came out on these very large canvases. And then I had the Frederica Hunter was showing them, and because of probably Frederica, the Whitney Museum had these young curators, one of whom was Marcia Tucker.
Mm-hmm.
And she sent out a group of young people to various locations other than New York. So one of them, one woman named Heidi Solomon, showed up in Houston. And somehow she heard about me, either through Frederica or Jim Harithus or whatever. And so she came to the studio and saw the works I was doing then, 1973, 74. And she took the word back to the Whitney, and that's when the Whitney chose me to be in the 1974 Biennale. I remember the day that I heard about it. It was wonderful. Frederica had organized this marvelous concert at the Museum of Fine Arts of Phil Glass and his ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
So we were all sitting around the big room at the old Museum of Fine Arts. There was Phil Glass doing this, and Frederica walked by me. She says, "You're in the Whitney this year." It's like, oh, I'm in the Whitney. I'm in the Whitney.
pretty exciting.
It was very exciting, and I was like, I had nobody to tell. I had lost my wife, and I had left the guys who were sitting on the other side of the room from me, mm-hmm. gambling and Tatum, sitting over there, you know. And I was like, I couldn't tell them. So I just like, God damn, I'm in the Whitney. Whoa.
Did you get to tell anybody?
No, I don't remember.
Just you and Frederica talk about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that was it. And this was, I think, just pre-Chaucer days. But the other thing of the Whitney wasn't that, was a big deal. It wasn't that big deal it is now.
No.
No, the Whitney now is a career maker. At that time, it was like, oh, it was she was severely criticized for the show because who were all these weird people in it? But the best known person that was in that show is a woman named Susan Rothenberg,
mm-hmm.
who made a big name. It still has a huge name for mm-hmm. herself. But she was also in that show. Nobody else said it. You remember?
You know, Earl, you've mentioned several times Chaucer's, and someone could be listening to these stories and think, Chaucer's, what is he talking about? Why don't you describe Chaucer's?
Chaucer's was a bar and restaurant underneath of the old Plaza Hotel, a block from the museums. And it was a real dump. It looked awful, sort of old decayed furniture in a sort of pseudo-medieval style with paintings, pseudo-Chaucerian paintings on the wall. And Harithus found it, or maybe Jim Agee from the museum found it too, because he would be down there for lunch every day. And so Harithus started hanging out down there, and Agee was hanging out down there, and pretty soon he invited artists down there, and all his visiting dignitaries would show up down there. And then we heard that it was sort of, oh, okay, let's go down there. And Thursday night was artist night. So we were there for about a year, and then whoever was handling the restaurant changed hands. And so they revamped the museum. They tore out all the old and put in this new, we never liked the decor that they put in. And so they changed the decor, and they put us up. They wanted to keep the artists. So they made special artists' night. So we were placed in an upstairs room. And the person who was hired to run the restaurant and keep the artists there was my wife, Suzanne. So she had the Herculean job of dealing with all us horny, rowdy, crazy artists, mostly male.
Poor girl.
Yeah.
Poor girl.
She was great, of course. And then within, I don't know how long it took for us to move back downstairs, but then she was the hostess down there too, and she had to, she had a yeoman's job of maintaining the art crowd and all the other people that was crowding. She has great stories of the days of Chaucer's, because it became, you know, the spot to be in Houston at that period, probably 73, 74, 75, probably 76 or something. I know that when she left there and when he got married, we started doing something else, and of course we knew we didn't go back. But the edge was off. We had something else to do. And but for that period of time, it was fun. It was a hub of information, activity, museum people, visiting artists. They were all there.
Was there anybody from Houston that went up with you for the Whitney?
No.
So no. You?
I just went up there, and I didn't go to the opening. I did not go to the Whitney opening.
Why?
Probably couldn't afford it. I had my job, but I was literally penniless. Suzanne says, when I met you, you didn't have furniture, which is true. I had a bed that I made against the wall, and I had a table and a chair, and I had nothing else other than my easel and my walls and balls intact. So she says, don't you complain about not having money. You've done very well since then because of me. I said, you're absolutely right, dear. You're absolutely right, hands down. But at that time, I was really in bad shape. Consequently, soon after that, Marcia Tucker left the Whitney, and she founded her own museum. And she had her first idea was she wanted bad. Her idea was bad art. She saw a movement across the United States called bad art. And according to what I did, what I was doing then, a number of other people, we were doing bad art. We were no longer doing color field or minimalist or that. So she had a show at her new museum in New York called Bad Art. I was in it. I was one of the bad artists, and that got me started.
Anybody else from Houston in it?
No.
Just you?
I was the bad artist. I did go up for that opening. That was fun. I was with Suzanne by that time. So I went up for that opening. And then things started picking up for me professionally. So I had a good 10 years.
Good.
76 through 86, I guess. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
But it was all because of this initial contact via Whitney in New York and probably via Frederica Hunter. That got me started someplace other than Houston.
And then before that, Herathus kind of stirring up.
Herathus was the same time as this Whitney thing. Almost coincided with that. I know that the Whitney showed up at my doorstep about the year I was getting a divorce, my lowest period.
Isn't it interesting how
Herathus showed up? All of this showed up.
A door closes and a door opens. Yeah, it's really true when you can look back.
Yes, yes. And when I left Frederica, I went over to Marvin Watson's gallery. In hindsight, I should have gone to Betty Moody. I went to Watson because I thought that he had more New York clout. Consequently, of course, he didn't. And so that was a mistake on my part to go with Marvin rather than with Moody. Well, I went to Moody eventually, but I should have been with Moody from that period. So it was a mistake. But Marvin was okay with me for a number of years.
Now, Earl, we've talked for about we look back, maybe 30 years? And, of course, we're 2006 now, but in thinking back and remembering these recollections we've talked about, what would you say to someone today in 2006 who is an aspiring or wants to be an aspiring artist?
If you have to do it, if you absolutely have to do it, do it. But my idea is you shouldn't get involved in it because you will only be discouraged constantly. So it's my job as a teacher to discourage you, more or less. I've been teaching more or less 40 years. I did have a 10-year span of time when I wasn't teaching full-time due to Europe, etc. But I've been back in it now for 15 years at a community college. But I think you say that anybody who's an art major, but this is true for any major, 99%, 0.99, will not go on past school, either undergraduate or graduate school, because you can't make a living in it. But you can't make a living as a history major either. But the expectations, the ego buildup that you get out of an art school thinks that you end up saying, well, I just had the best show anyway. I had my graduate school show. And it probably is the best show you'll ever do in your life. Because the pressure was on, the peer pressure is there, your friends are there, et cetera, et cetera. But after you get out of school, nobody gives a diddle. Oh, he's still here?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's, I don't know if it's any different now or not, but certainly the jobs aren't there in teaching, unless you go into part-time teaching at a community college and hope that I retire. So I say artists should be discouraged at all costs. Because the consequences are that you will end up being an artist at the age of 50, but you don't have anything to fall back on. You don't have a trade or craft. Some of the people that I had as students at St. Thomas, they made a good job becoming framers or carpenters. The framing business was very popular and very successful for some of my art majors.
Mm-hmm.
But of all the students that I have had, I only know of four or five, six who are still practicing artists.
Professional artists.
Yeah, professional. One is a female artist, a very good artist, but she's also married. She married another teacher, physics teacher, scientist, so she get to practice. But that's the story of art majoring, is a lot of discouragement. I was told that to be a success, and this was when I was in New York, you have to be very good, but you also have to be very lucky and very crafty. You have to know how to work the crowd. You have to go out and hustle your work. So if you're not a good hustler, if you're not a people person hustler to sell what you do, it's not going to happen. And that wasn't me.
I mean, a lot of visual artists don't realize how important it is to be able to communicate about what you're trying to do to people and talk about it.
God, I just get tongue-tied. I was like, oh.
Well, I
just don't know what to say other than, well, that's what I do. Here it is. You ask me a question, maybe I can fill you in. But right now it's like, well, I want my saying else. Why do you do it? I do it to amuse myself.
You paint to amuse?
Yeah. If it doesn't amuse me, I ain't going to do it. And I'll amuse myself so long with this, and then I'll do something else.
But looking back, though, when you're a young man, I think, or a young woman, I think you have there's a spark in a person that demands that they pick up that brush. And it's hard to turn your back on that.
Yeah, and if that's you,
right,
stay in.
Then you've got to do it because
you
can't turn your back on it.
Yes, right.
And maybe the comment here would be that if you do it, be able to talk about it too. Be able to talk about it to others.
I remember when I was in graduate school in Arkansas, and I was up there in my studio painting away, and I knew there were four or five other graduate students, but they weren't there with me painting. So about the second week into school, I walked over, and there they were in the faculty lounge having coffee. So they were hanging out. What am I doing? I'm painting pictures. You know, crazy. I'm just so tickled to death to be here just to be able to paint a picture and just do it. And they were over there having coffee.
And they did paint a picture or two, though, probably.
Once in a while.
Yeah.
And that was it. So I never did like to schmooze or hang out. I'd rather be in the studio painting because that's who I am. Consequently, there I am.